We have 30 seconds. What has surprised you most about what is happening today?
Very little at this point, I'm sorry to say, surprises me. But the general indifference by the American political and intellectual elites to the relationship between the war on terror and the erosion of democracy is also a very deep thread and very historically rooted, not just in the war on terror, but before. And certainly seeing that those connections have to be made in order to have any form of real democracy in this country and safety and dignity for so many people.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter, his new book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH.
Hey, KBOO members. It's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KBOO members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KBOO's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KBOO depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September 13th, please contact the membership department or vote online at kboo.fm. Ballots cast by mail must be received by Friday, September 24th. The deadline to vote electronically is September 19th and will reopen during the annual meeting in lieu of voting in person. If you are not a member, you can become one today by going to kboo.fm and clicking the Join Now button. Again, that's KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information about the annual meeting, candidate bios, and online voting forms can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2021. That's kboo.fm/meeting2021.
Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. No contracts, no snacks, say Nabisco workers on strike in 5 states. They don't care about frontline workers. They only care about the almighty dollar. We're tired of getting stepped on and treated like trash. We've had enough, says striking Nabisco worker Rusty Lewis.
We're joined now by 3 of the strikers from the Richmond, Virginia plant, Darlene Carpenter, Janelle Lambert-Watkins, and Christine Brown. Members of Local 358 of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers Union.
We're talking to Nabisco workers on strike in 5 states over pensions and outsourcing. And the first question is, should I throw away my Oreos, throw away my Ritz crackers until you as workers get what you want and need?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, you should. Absolutely.
Would we carry that through and say that we're actually telling people to boycott the company until such time as they give the workers their just due?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you heard it here. No more Ritz, no more Oreos.
until the workers are compensated as they deserve to be. So with that, why don't we go around and talk about the kind of work that you folks do for Nabisco, how long you've been working there, and what it's been like to work in the plants. Why don't we get started with, how about Christine?
I've been with Nabisco for 20 years. I'm a packing technician on the Ritz line. I package the Ritz. It's been a challenge, especially during last year, during COVID. We worked through the whole pandemic and got no compensation. All we get is a slap in the face with all this outsourcing of our jobs to Mexico, and they want to change our work schedule as if we're not working enough hours as it is, and they talk about it's for a better home-life balance. How can it be? Now you disrupting my life balance with a 12-hour shift, when normally my shift is just 8 hours. So you're not making it better for me. You're making it worse.
Janelle, talk about the work that you do.
I'm a mixing technician, and I mix the ingredients. I've been there 13 and a half years. And the conditions are, they want you to do certain things on the job, but they don't sanitize. And through the pandemic, as Christine said, we worked through the pandemic, but no sanitation is being done. And then they want you to come in to work. Even when we have gotten cases for COVID, they still want you to work, even though you've been around people that have COVID. You can go get tested, but that's not the right way to do it. That's definitely not the right way to do it. You want to make sure your workers that are making these cookies for the consumer are protected as well. We don't want to have COVID and working, making cookies, and we're not safe, and they're not making us safe all at the same time.
How many workers are in the plant that you're both in?
Go ahead, Darlene.
436 members at the Richmond plant. It's actually a really good mixture. Probably a little bit more men than women, but for the most part, pretty good mixture. We've got people that have worked there for 45 years. Their children or spouses are working there. It used to be a really nice family affair at this plant until it started changing hands. And once it went over into Kraft and they spun off Mondelez, that's when things started going downhill for the workers in the plant.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I don't understand is this thing with the work hours and how that affects you and what exactly it means. So who wants to tell me about that?
This is Christine. I can speak on it. Right now, we have an 8-hour shift. Anything after 8 hours is either time and a half, and on Sundays is double time. They want to change that to a 12-hour shift with straight time. They saying it's for a better work home balance. It can't be. How can it be better when you're cutting my salary, because now I'm working 12 hours with no overtime pay, and on top of that, you're cutting my premium pay. And if it's for a better work-life balance, you're making it worse, because if you got children, how are you going to get your children on and off of the school bus or on and off school when you're working 12 hours and it's no guarantee you can go home after that 12 hours? You can get, and they stated, you can get forced up to 60 hours per week. So how is that a better work-life balance when now regularly we work typically 40 hours a week? Anything over that is chosen, can choose when we want to work on Saturday and Sunday. That's a choice we make if the lines is running. But the way they want to go to it, it's no choice. You could be working Saturday and Sunday regardless.
And Janelle and Christine, both of you also talk about daily, what it's like to work. I mean, to get some sense of the kind of the pride that people go to work with and the blood, sweat, and tears that people like yourself have put into the Nabisco plant where you work for decades now.
It used to be a great place to work, as Darlene stated, until Mondelez took over. When it started shifting hands and Mondelez took over, you could see the morale in the plant has just gone down here. People, damn, they don't care. You know, they come to work and they do their job, but they don't care about the quality of the product like it used to be, because the management don't care. We go to them and tell them this not looking right. They tell you to run it anyway. When you tell them, no, I can't run this because my family eat this, they be you going to run this because I said so. The quality of the product is not the way it used to be, because their focus is getting out numbers as opposed to getting out quality products. And case in point, if you get a package of our products, if you can find it, made here in Richmond, and a package from Mexico, you can see the difference. We can tell that those made in Mexico, no, they don't care about it because it's crumbly, it doesn't taste as good. And look at coming from Richmond, we put out a better quality product, but it's not like it used to be.
And tell us what your job is like on a day-to-day basis, the labor, the energy that you put in. What's it like?
I go to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I live an hour and 45 minutes away. I'm happy to get up and go to work, but when Mondelez has taken over, it's like I hate to get up now, but I know I have a job to do, and I'm going to do that job regardless. But I'm not looking for no pat on the back. It's just that doing your workers some justice, and this the thanks we get. You want to take all our benefits away. You want to pay us low pay. You want to do everything to us but the right thing. I make the ingredients, mix the ingredients up, and I love doing what I do. I rotate different lines every day and make sure the product is standard, the highest standard it could be. Now, I can't speak for everybody else in the plant, but we all try to make sure that that cookie is what the consumer wants.
To piggyback off of what Janella just said, I love my job too. It's just the working conditions. They come in, want to take, but they not rewarding us for the hard work that we done put in. They got all these signs posted all around the plant talking about heroes work here, but you're not treating us like heroes. You're treating us like stray off the street just coming in because you want to take everything from us. You want to change our work schedule. You want us to pay for insurance that we done paid for over the years by concession, by not getting raises, but yet and still, you gonna put up these banners that's supposed to make us feel better. Heroes work here. We don't feel like heroes. We feel like somebody that you don't care about, because if you treat heroes like this, that shows how you're treating everybody else.
Well, let's just back up for a second. You mentioned insurance. Does that mean health insurance? What's happening with health insurance?
Yes, they want to change that also. They want the new people coming in to pay for the insurance, whereas right now we don't pay for it. But technically we have paid for it because over the years we have gave up raises so we could keep the health insurance. So we paid for it, but now they want to backtrack and want us to pay for it again. That's not fair to us. And not fair to the young people coming in either, because if they find out, oh, they got to pay for insurance that we don't have to pay for, that's a way that they want to divide us.
I want to get on board with understanding more about the downsizing. What I understand is nearly 2,000 jobs to Mexico. Tell us about that.
The company actually shut down two plants this year. In June, they shut down their Atlanta, Georgia plant. In July, they shut down their Fairlawn, New Jersey plant. That took about 1,000 workers out of work. That cut our membership as union members 50%. And the company saved $300 million by shutting that plant down. Now, we've asked the company, would they repatriate that product to Chicago, Portland, and Richmond? And we asked what in writing, and they wouldn't do it. But yet, they're telling the public, we didn't send anything overseas. Of course you did. You sent it to Mexico. They are killing the American middle class jobs. We can't compete with Mexico. They make 97 cents an hour. Did y'all hear what I said? 97 cents? That's ridiculous. That's slave labor. And I get passionate about it because it makes me angry. Not only are they treating the American workers wrong, but they're treating the Mexico workers wrong too. So our campaign right now is not to boycott all the products, but to boycott the Mexican products and start letting their American plants start producing the stuff and keeping the middle class jobs here instead of shipping everything over there. Our people at the plant have a fear. Are we going to be the next plant that gets shut down? You know, we worked through this major pandemic, and we're still in this pandemic. And the reward that they gave our plants in New Jersey and in Georgia was to shut them down. How horrible. Shame on Nabisco for what they've done. And now we're at the at these crossroads with our negotiation. They weren't everything that we've gone to the table with, and I have been personally at these negotiations, has been a takeaway. If you guys excuse my voice, me and the bullhorn out on the picket line, I think the bullhorn won. But everything's a takeaway with the company. All they want is concessions, concessions, concessions. Like Christine was talking about, the alternative work schedule, which is a 12-hour shift, alternate days, but they can force you up to 60 hours a week. By doing that, what they're also doing is taking away our premium pay. So that's going to cost their workers anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 a year in overtime pay. That's a major takeaway. And with our health insurance, what they want to do is a two-tier system. We have 100% health care, but we pay for this with concessions over the years. We have given up raises in order to have what we have today. So what the company has proposed, any new hires would have to pay for theirs, and we could keep what we had till the end of the new contract. We said no. We're not selling out any new employees. We are a union. We are union strong, and we are family strong. We would never do that. And I'm appalled that the company would even ask us to do something like that. But then again, it's another way of busting our union up. That really pissed me off, to say the least. Back during the pandemic, with our people working as hard as they were working, they came to us in March. They were going to give them our appreciation check for the hours that they worked for the entire year. They came to our people with a $300 check before they took taxes out. And I thought, are you kidding me? They just made $28 billion in revenues, and they gave us $300, took taxes out of that. I took that $300, and I divided it by 52. They valued their workers at $5.77 a week during a pandemic, where they were risking their own lives and risking their family and loved ones' lives. This is what we're dealing with. It gets to the point that you have to say, when is enough enough? You know, they stole our pension. Now they're trying to take everything else away from us. Corporate greed at its finest. And it's right here at Mondelez. And the people have finally came to the point that we're not going to take it anymore. So we're walking that picket line right now, 24/7. The temperatures down here in Richmond have been in the 90s, 98, 97. I mean, it's extremely hot. But we're out there walking. We've been in torrential downpours. These people have not let up. We started this fight on the 16th of August. They are still going strong. And I give them kudos, because if that doesn't tell the world they are fighting for what they believe in, I don't know what else would.
Darlene, describe a little for us your background and relationship. You're a union leader, organizer at this point. Did you come up from the ranks, and how did you begin to take a stand and work in this plant?
Well, I've worked at the plant for 14 years. This June, I was elected as the business agent, financial secretary for the local 358. So I just left that plant in June to take this new role on. So I've been in those trenches. I know how I was treated there. I know how my coworkers feel. We came in day in, day night. You never know if you get to go home, because an hour before your shift ends, they could be forcing you over, which they did a lot of. They're working 16-hour shifts. You're tired. You're scared. You don't know if you're going to be the next one to get sick. But the work itself is very physical, demanding work. We're standing on concrete floors. That wears on you. And then the morale in the plant has been horrible. Ever since the company took the pensions, such low morale, to the point that you got up in the morning and you were pulling into that parking lot, you felt the tension. I mean, you could cut it with a knife. It was that thick. You just didn't want to be there. No one should have to work like that.
And Janelle and Christine, you're out on the picket lines in this hot weather. What kind of support are you getting from the community?
It's outpouring support. Outpouring. We get donations daily. They come out and help us picket on the lines. I mean, just a whole lot of support, mental
yes.
support. And they're
yes.
sometimes they're 24 hours with us, supporting us.
Yes, the community has been great. We've even had people come from out of town bringing Gatorade, water, ice, just to say, we with you, we support you. The support is great, and yes, it's hot.
It's hot. We've been out there, but we make sure we keep something to drink. We keep hydrated. We out there, we fighting for our livelihood, because if we give the company what they want, then they go keep on taking till we have nothing. But the community have really stepped up. People that we thought wouldn't, they really come through, and they really stepping up for us. So I got to give kudos to the community.
And we're talking about more than 1,000 workers who are on strike at Nabisco's U.S. bakeries and distribution centers. Workers on strike represent Nabisco's only remaining U.S. bakeries in Portland, Oregon, Chicago, Illinois, and Richmond, Virginia. And Nabisco workers at the company's distribution centers in Aurora, Colorado, and Norcross, Georgia, are also on strike. Talk to us more about this whole issue of transitioning, or the stealing, the theft of jobs, how and when that began to happen, and sending them down to Mexico, the change in the company with the new ownership. I mean, talk to us about that process and how infuriating that must be. You know, tell us more about the greed and the profit drive, and how are we to understand this new company that came in when, frankly, Nabisco was doing quite darn well to begin with, profit-wise?
Well, I mean, when they do things, they tell us about it afterwards. They don't outright let us know. It's afterwards. And then we find out about it when they send out a memo, and then you hear about it later. It's been something with this company. Only thing they want to do to us is send our jobs to Mexico. On top of that, these new lines that they bring in, you're not being trained correctly. As far as the transition, there's basically no transition. There's more of a, they're going to do it, and we find out about it later. The workers are always the last to know anything. Always.
But we're the ones putting in all the hard work. And if something goes wrong, they come running to us, want us to tell them how to do this, how to do that. But you're not telling us, oh, look, we're getting ready to sell y'all to Mondelez, and we're sending X amount of jobs to Mexico. They're not telling us anything. Like Janella said, we're the last ones to know anything, but we're putting in the hard work. And the training is awful. And they preach safety. They don't care whether we're safe or not. They showed us on that during the pandemic, because if they cared about us, they would have brought in professionally trained cleaners when this COVID first hit to sanitize and clean that whole plant. They did it after the fact. And they still don't have no set protocol as to how they cleaning, what people supposed to do if they found out they get it or whatever. Yeah, they got a little thing in writing, you do this if you found out you tested. But every time a case come up, then they change what they got in place. How are we supposed to feel like we safe and we care about what we doing if you're not doing it yourself? Because, see, they don't care. They set up in the front office and behind the desk all day. They don't come out on that packing floor and see how hard we work or what we going through. During that whole pandemic, we might have seen a supervisor once per day and on payday for them to hand out our paycheck. They ain't come out around us. But then cases popped up in the plant. It wasn't among the supervisors. It was among the workers, because they are not sanitizing like they should.
Just to bring up a point, over the last 7 years, Nabisco has closed 3 of their plants. They downsized some other ones, and they shipped 2,000 good middle-class jobs to Mexico. Right now, they're threatening to ship more jobs to Mexico if we, as a union, don't agree to their demands for their major concessions in this new contract. They're making record profits. Tell us something about who these CEOs are and their profit rate. Oh, he's making billions. This guy is Dirk Vanderput. He has just taken, I think he just took a bonus. I don't want to quote the wrong figure, but it was like $13 million. And the bonus just took, they're not hurting for money. Let me tell you, it's just
apparently they don't have enough in their pocket as it is. They want to take everything else from us. He works under the European schedules as far as how they treat their people. Americans aren't going to put up with that. Enough is enough. But this guy, I'm not for sure where he lives at. I wish I kind of knew, but I don't. Maybe it's a good thing I don't. But, you know, just the money that this guy is making and the concessions they're asking for, you know, and us asking for them to put a commitment in writing that they're going to keep the jobs here in America and they won't do that, that gives you a real uneasy feeling. What is their game plan? 10 years down the road, are we going to have any American plants producing it? Was everything going overseas for the slave labor?
But I'm also interested in, Ken asked you about the community support. You said the community's really united. I'm interested, yeah, though, in two things. What this means for the community to have all these folks out, and whether or not the local politicos, whether your politicians are weighing in on this as well.
Yeah, our politicians have been coming out, given their support, given speeches. They've actually donated. We have a GoFundMe fund. They've actually donated to that. They're talking to other politicians. The community, they've been awesome, coming out bringing ice and water. You know, they've walked the lines with us. Our community is a very close-knit community. A lot of us that work in that plant live in this community. If this plant was to go under, that would kill this community. We support the community by going to the grocery stores, and not just the grocery stores. We do all of our local shopping and stuff, and it's hurting the community right now because we don't have the money to be out there supporting them right now because we're not getting a paycheck. So would it devastate the community? I think yes, would, in a whole lot of different ways. You know, the housing industry, everything would fall apart. You'd have people losing their homes, foreclosures. Everything's affected. It's a trickle-down effect.
And you know this to be the case also in the other plants, too, because as we said, we're talking about five cities where Nabisco workers are on strike. So what's the communication there? And is it the same kind of close-knit family of workers and with the same kind of effects in really destroying small communities where these plants are the center fold of the workforce?
Absolutely it is. I've been keeping in touch with Portland. Cameron Taylor is their business agent out there. Their community is behind them 100%, and they're overwhelmed with the support they're getting in a good way. I've talked to Veronica Hopkins up in Chicago. You know, Chicago, they lost 600 jobs to Mexico several years back. Now, this is another hard hit for them. And yes, it is affecting them extremely hard. They're getting a lot of support. I would have to say the solidarity for all three of our plants that are still here in the United States has been overwhelming. It's been awesome. And then the other unions that are stepping up now and coming out to help us. We've had the United Food and Commercial Workers out there. We've had the teacher unions. We've had the Teamsters. We've had the IBUs. We've had CWA, Industrial Workers of the World. I mean, they're all behind us and supporting us. And this is something that I don't think a lot of people realize, but this is a historic thing that's happening right now. This plant has never been on strike here in Richmond. The last strike was 52 years ago in Chicago. We are trying to set a precedent that American workers will not take this anymore. Corporate greed has got to stop.
And so lastly, how do our listeners help you? Boycott Nabisco, and what else? Who do they send letters to? Who do they send messages to? What do they do to help you financially?
If they want to do a financial support, I know that Richmond and Portland both have GoFundMe accounts out there online. So we got those. And then with, I'm not for sure if Chicago has it yet or not, but they could always write a check to their local, which is local number one in Chicago, CCTGM, local number one, to help those guys out. For financial support, that'd be awesome. If they want to start writing letters to our CEO at Mondelez, I encourage that. You know, if you're near anywhere where these strikes are going on, please go out and support these people. After we've been up there 24/7, we're tired. We need that boost. We need to know that people are behind us. That support means a lot to us. So those are different things that they can do to help us. We're not asking them to boycott all the Visco products. We're asking them to boycott anything made in Mexico. And it will show it on the label. It'll say made in Mexico, or it will say MM or MS. They have two state-of-the-art plants down there. If they could boycott that, that would be a tremendous help to us.
Darlene Carpenter, Janelle Lambert Watkins, Christine Brown, Nabisco strikers from the Richmond, Virginia plant stay strong and will boycott those Nabisco snacks made in Mexico until you all receive a fair contract. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis, Capitalism Has Become Techno-Feudalism. The former Greek finance minister in conversation with Dr. Mark Lamont Hill on Al Jazeera, February 2021.
We no longer live under capitalism. Capitalism has morphed into what I call a techno-feudalism, in the sense that, you know, you don't have a competitive capitalist economy. You've got some very few platform companies that effectively own the market. They don't monopolize it, like Amazon, for instance. Once you are into Amazon or Facebook, you're not in capitalism, you are in a kind of Soviet regime owned by one man.
That's Yanis Varoufakis on techno-feudalism, a term that's in the news these days. It may mean control of the data by the few FANG companies. That's Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Alphabet, formerly known as Google. Techno-feudalism also applies to the dominance of finance and banking over state institutions, driving huge wealth inequalities with socialism for the rich and austerity for the rest. Yanis Varoufakis is the former finance minister of Greece and professor of economics at the University of Athens. He's co-founder of the Democracy in Europe movement, DiEM25. They see the European Union becoming a technocratic superstate and aim to create more democracy. Varoufakis is being interviewed by Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. He's professor of Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University and an award-winning journalist and author. He's host of Upfront on Al Jazeera.
Why are billionaires making trillions of dollars in the middle of a pandemic? I'll ask economist and former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
It's a pleasure.
Recently, an Oxfam study found that since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the world's 10 richest men have seen their wealth increase by a combined $500 billion. That's more than enough money to cover the cost of vaccination for everybody on the planet. Who should be held responsible for this kind of gross inequality and injustice?
The crash of 2008, our generation's 1929. Nothing has been the same since then. Come to think of it, immediately after 2008, the great and the good, the central banks primarily, and of course governments, got together at the G20 level, if you recall, April 2009, and they started refloating the financial markets by means of state money, printed by central banks primarily. For 12 years, even before COVID-19 hit, we have been creating this kind of boisterous financial market environment with stagnation for the real economy, for real capitalism, for, you know, small businesses, medium-sized businesses, even some large businesses. And then COVID-19 comes and hits us. We do a lot more of that QE stuff, money printing. The financial markets now have exited the stratosphere, whereas the rest of the economy is tanking. The result is the top 0.01% are doing very well, thank you, and the rest of the global society is suffering.
You talk about 2008. I want to push on that a little bit more, because in 2008, you're right, we printed more money. We gave it back to corporations who bought back their shares, and they didn't invest. This was the fix in 2008, and it seems to be our same strategy here during the pandemic. Is it that we've learned nothing, or is oligarchy just indomitable? What's the answer for this replication of the process?
It seems that those in positions of power, of authority, are like the Bourbons. They forget nothing and they learn nothing. And, you know, why is business not investing? It's not that they don't want to invest. It's not some conspiracy. They look around and they look at the little people who are being subjected to stringent austerity, whether they are in Greece, not just in Greece and Puerto Rico, but even in Germany, in France, in the United States of America, the vast majority of people have been treated to austerity, cutbacks. Even the Obama stimulus never went to the little people. It ran out of path very quickly. States were cutting. So we had 12 years of austerity for the many and socialism for the financiers. The result is companies look around and see people who do not have the capacity to buy new expensive stuff. So they don't invest in it. They take the money that the state prints, and as you correctly put it, they go to the stock exchange and buy back their own shares. This is wasted energy. It boosts inequality and creates stagnation for the many.
You talk about the stock exchange and also the U.S. economy. Right now, the U.S. economy is in shambles. Last year, it shrank by 3.5%. That's the worst we've seen since the end of World War II. Unemployment's higher than it was during the 2008 financial crisis. And yet Wall Street, they did pretty well in 2020. And it's not just the U.S. If we look in the U.K., we see a very similar thing. We see the London Stock Exchange jumped 2% on the very same day that the news broke that the economy was shrinking. There seems to be a huge gap between what the markets are saying and what reality is saying. Why?
Because we no longer live under capitalism. Capitalism has morphed into what I call a techno-feudalism, in the sense that, you know, you don't have a competitive capitalist economy with boisterous competition. You've got some very few platform companies that effectively own the market. They don't monopolize it, just they own it, like Amazon, for instance. Once you are into Amazon or Facebook, you're not in capitalism, you are in a kind of Soviet regime owned by one man, really. And the rest of the market economy is shrinking, it is in stagnation. Money is being pumped by central banks, struggling to keep the whole thing, the whole show on the road. The money ends up with the large corporations that already have savings that they're not investing because of the little people's impecunity. So they go to the stock exchange and buy back their own shares. So you have the London Stock Exchange, the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, the Paris Stock Exchange, you know, and of course New York, doing remarkably well at a time when the vast majority are suffering.
You mentioned this idea that we're no longer in capitalism, and I read something, a speech of yours at the launch of the Project for Peace and Justice of January of this year. You said capitalism has already morphed into something even worse. As you said, I call it techno-feudalism. We don't even have capitalism. The Amazons of the world, the Facebooks of the world, powered by public money, by the Bank of England, European Central Bank, the Fed, they are combining the worst of the state with the worst of private monopolies. If these companies have monopolies and they're being propped up by the state, if tech companies are the ones with all the power, and they're not accountable to any electorate, what do we do? What's the solution?
We get organized. It's the way we got out of, you know, authoritarian regimes in previous centuries. It's the way that we imposed democracy upon ruling classes. Remember, ruling classes never wanted democracy. Even the liberals of the 19th century. And that is something that those who are criticizing China today must remember. British liberalism, you know, that went hand in hand with capitalism, was anti-democratic. We are condemned to fight the same struggle again and again for democracy.
The idea of everyday people pushing back against these corporate oligarchies, pushing back against corporate power, fighting the markets, is something that we're watching in real time in a certain kind of way. In late January, we saw the Reddit rebellion, right, where social media users took on Wall Street hedge funds by turning the game on them. They drove up stock prices and not only made cash for themselves, but they also sabotaged short selling, and where Wall Street investors bet against struggling companies like a GameStop, which is obviously the target. In response, of course, we saw the trading app Robinhood suspend trading for specific securities, inviting a kind of bipartisan outrage. Is this kind of resistance the new type of resistance that might actually generate change? Is this what we need to do? Is it even possible to sustain that?
Well, it's a mixed picture. It is not a revolution. It's not Occupy Wall Street through financial means. I wish it were. 6 months ago, I published a political science fiction novel called Another Now. You will excuse me for plugging it. But in it, I described the kind of revolution that would involve financial engineering. An element of that we saw in GameStop, an element of that, but it was not a rebellion. The interesting aspect of the GameStop episode is that indeed, as you mentioned, you had 4.4 million people getting together to make money, right? It was not purely ideological, of course. It was to make money. But a substantial proportion of these millions of people didn't care about so much making money. They didn't even mind losing the money they put in it. They wanted to sock it to the hedge funds. So there is an element of ideology there. There is an element of collective action through financial circuits.
Giannis, then what's missing if there's a kind of anti-capital, maybe not anti-capitalist, but certainly anti-corporate impulse there? It's organized action. What makes that, in your estimation, distinct than Occupy, which you call a movement, and this seems like more just a singular tactic? What would make it a full-fledged movement, and is this replicable?
Well, two things are missing. The first is a manifesto, a vision. What do we want to put in place of these financial markets that are broken? They are not working for humanity, they're working for the finances. Yeah? What would markets look like if you removed this virus of financialization from it? And the second thing that we need is an alliance between different kinds of people and different movements. It is when the Reddit crowd get together with trades unions, get together with climate change activists in order to pursue a vision for the world, that is when we're going to have a revolution.
One thing that might be surprising to many is that stimulus spending in the United States was actually much bigger than it was in Europe. If you look at deficit spending by the US government, it was nearly twice as much as Europe, which is very interesting because the EU is more progressive on these issues around housing, around healthcare, et cetera. When it comes to public spending in general, we would intuitively think that it would be the EU that would spend more. Why is the EU spending so much less in response to COVID by comparison?
Will you permit me to challenge this perspective?
I would love that.
I think the European Union has always been more conservative when it comes to public spending than the United States. Remember, the Americans have no deficit phobia. No, Richard Nixon, on the 15th of August, 1971, famously blew up the Bretton Woods system and said, okay, it's our currency, it's your problem. That's what he said to the Europeans. And they started spending as if there's no tomorrow. And the second phase, globalization, you know, if you want, or financialization, the second post-war phase after the early 1970s, was predicated upon the United States becoming, you know, a huge vacuum cleaner, using its trade deficit to suck into its territory the net exports of Germany, of Holland, of Japan, and of course later of China, and creating the world as we know it. So, whereas the European Union, think of what happened after 2008. We had created, come to think of it, just think of this. We had created a central bank without a state or a treasury to have its back, and 19 treasuries or governments without a central bank to have their bank. So when the banks of France, Germany, Greece, Portugal, Ireland collapsed, they didn't do what the British did or what the Americans did, which is to, you know, tell the central bank, print the money to save them. No, they transferred wealth from the poorest of the Europeans to the financiers. And the result is we had 12 years of stagnation, of austerity that, you know, in Europe is just abysmal compared to what the Americans experienced. So yes, even though there is a social democratic, if you want, ethos in Europe during the good times, when capitalism goes through a spasm, America always responds more in a more Keynesian fashion, if you want. Even Ronald Reagan was a Keynesian president compared to anything that we've seen in France or in Germany. And the result is that every crisis, global crisis, leaves Europe weaker and more injured and wounded compared to the United States than the previous crisis.
How much of that response, the Keynesian response that you mentioned, is due to accountability? There are mechanisms, for example, the U.S. Fed is accountable to Congress. It's accountable ultimately to an electorate in a sense, whereas the European Central Bank, which you mentioned, is not. The EU Commission is not. How much of this is ideological and how much of it is about the sort of mechanisms and structures of government?
The reason why the United States managed to get together is the response of the political system in the United States to previous crises. Firstly, the creation of the Fed in the first decade of the 20th century was due to a financial disaster. And much more importantly, 1929 and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which created, in a sense, all those institutions like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Social Security and Medicare, and later with the Great Society of LBJ, that was all strengthened. These are all the institutions that were put in place and which the European Union never had, especially the European Monetary Union. So when 2008 took place, you know, Americans did not need to rely on politicians doing the right thing because those mechanisms were there and automatically absorbed a lot of those shock waves. Whereas in the European Union, we had, you know, a comedy of errors produced a great deal of inhumanity. If you look at the way my country was treated, if you look at the way that, you know, the German workforce was being treated all those years, condemned to stagnation, because we never had those federal institutions.
I want to pivot a little bit and talk about the disproportionate impact that the pandemic will have, at least according to the UN, on women. Women will be pushed into extreme poverty. For example, there's a woman, Margaret Rahman. She's a single mother of five from South Sudan. She makes a living selling beans at a local market. Since the pandemic, her income has dropped more than 50%. That's just one example of what we're talking about. In the U.S., women lost 156,000 jobs in December. Men gained 16,000 jobs. That means that women accounted for more than 111% of all job losses that month. How would the solutions that you believe in remedy the various forms of gender inequality that we see globally?
Well, patriarchy and sexism cannot be solved through Keynesian means. We have to be clear on this. But what we must understand at the same time is that when you have a deep recession, the first people who get hit are women, ethnic minorities, generally the weaker, the young, those who are, you know, under 20, the very old. They are the first people. The weaker suffer the most during a recession. So any delay in responding to a spasm of this financialized techno-feudalism that we have by Keynesian means exacerbates the pain that the victims of patriarchy have been suffering. So on the one hand, we need to replace the lost incomes. We are replacing them anyway. You know, the central banks are printing a lot of money, but they're giving it to the wrong people. They're not giving it to the women, and they're not giving it to the poor. They're giving it to those who don't need it, to Jeff Bezos of the world, you know, and the corporations of the world that take it to the stock exchange and invest in their own shares again. So we, in a sense, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, who was not a revolutionary and he was not a left winger, had the right idea that in order to stabilize capitalism, even from the perspective of a capitalist, you need to look after the weak, who are the greatest victims of capitalism's idiocy.
I want to think a little bit more about these solutions, right? You say that patriarchy and sexism can't be resolved through Keynesian means. I guess my question is, what kind of interventions can we make that would yield some kind of equality on this front? For example, what would paying women for all domestic labor do as a possible solution? What do you make of that?
Oh, I'm totally against paying women for domestic duties because that assumes the domestic duties are a woman's job. And as a male of the, as a member of the defective sex, and that is as a man, I don't feel I have the right to say that. I want a basic dividend that is universal and goes to everyone.
But I guess what I mean, though, is if we recognize that a large part of why the domestic sphere is not invested in is because we see it as women's work and as part of a patriarchal vision, could we say that all domestic labor, not just for women, but for everyone, would be compensated as a means of evening out the playing field, as a means of providing more economic justice for women around the world who are often consigned to the domestic sphere?
But, you know, a universal basic dividend, let's say a payment of, let's make it modest, you know, $1,000 a month to each individual, you know, would do that without the bureaucracy of having to decide who is a domestic worker and who is not. There would be no punitive state deciding, you know, you are eligible, you're not. And that allows couples, that allows households to decide who is going to do their washing up, who is going to stay at home and look after, you know, the children, look after the elderly, without the state interfering in the distribution of these roles.
Another issue, in addition to the gender question, is that of race. The pandemic has revealed structural racism in new ways as well. If you look in Brazil, for example, people of Afro descent are 40% more likely to die of COVID than their white counterparts. In the United States, African Americans are 1.5 times more likely to be infected or die of COVID than their share of the population. One of the reasons for this, of course, is that we have these economies that are inherently racist and rooted in colonialism and slavery and such. How do the solutions that economists like yourself offer account for this kind of structural racism, this kind of deep-seated, historically rooted inequality?
Allow me to reflect for a moment. I'm one of those privileged white men who has spent the lockdown in isolation in a nice place, and only because there is an army of people out there doing all the work, you know, from garbage men and women to nurses and doctors to supermarket employees to Amazon warehouse workers and so on and so forth, right? Now, the proportion of ethnic minority people doing those jobs is much higher because of the history of exploitation and the history of racism. Any move towards removing the structural privileges of people like me is going to ameliorate the situation that you described, and it will cause a more balanced distribution, not just of income, but also of burdens.
Let's talk about the IMF for a moment. You, I see you light up a little bit. I know how much you love the IMF. you've been obviously very critical of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. In 2016, you used a phrase that I found very interesting. You accused them of fiscal waterboarding when they imposed strict austerity measures on Greece. The irony, though, is right now many progressives, including some of the largest humanitarian groups, are actually calling on the IMF to disperse a multi-trillion dollar COVID relief package that use funds that don't have to be repaid. Where do you stand on that? Is this a measure you'd support?
Absolutely, and I would like to actually strengthen it. Look, the International Monetary Fund is a creature created, born, during the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. The original idea was a splendid one. It would work like something like, you know, the central bank of the world. And for the first 20 years, the IMF did not do a bad job. I mean, it had to handle the fixed exchange rate regime. Things changed when Bretton Woods collapsed, but the IMF survived. To survive, it undertook a new role. It played the role of the bailiff of the Wall Street bankers, and the bankers of Frankfurt and London and Paris, visiting countries, especially in Africa in the late 1970s and later on in Asia and so on, effectively exacting a pound of flesh from the local population on behalf of the international bankers who demanded that their silly investments in those countries that were predatory loans, effectively, be repaid to the full through the privatization of things like hospitals and schools and everything else. So the IMF's role was totally transformed It went from the side of the good to, you know, to the side where
your phrase, the incompetent misanthropic troika was an apt.
That is correct.
I'm not suggesting
that the IMF should be abolished. What I and others who are suggesting that a number of SDRs are created in order to fund, a free vaccine for every human being program, to fund investment in green jobs in the developing world. What we're saying is the IMF should go back to what it was meant to be in 1944.
Before you go, I have a question for you about the Green New Deal. It's an idea, a vision at least, for a more just economic future that you've supported both in the EU and in the United States. Why has the left failed to implement such potentially effective policies?
Well, we've never been in power. I mean, here in Greece, we were in power for 5 months until they came down on us like a ton of bricks and destroyed us, remember? Beyond that, of course, we are leftists. Have a lot to answer for, because we are fantastic at dividing and multiplying and turning against one another. But primarily, allow me to say that, so that our viewers do not think that this is simply an ideological matter, it's a question of rationality, if I may say. Never before has humanity had so much money. We have the largest pile of savings and liquidity in the history of humanity. By comparison, the proportion of our savings that we are plowing into investment into the future, right? Into the green transition, green energy, you know, good quality jobs that can produce the incomes by which to repay the debts. The amount that we're investing has never been lower as proportion of the total savings in the history of the world. That is stupidity in action. And you don't have to be a left winger or a right winger to agree with that. It's wasted economic energy. And that should be, our guiding light, how to take the money which is there and invest it into the future of humanity, especially, the green transition which is necessary so that we can have a planet on which to flourish.
Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was former finance minister of Greece and professor of economics at the University of Athens, Yanis Varoufakis, interviewed by Dr. Mark Lamont Hill on Al Jazeera on February 19. 2021. In July 2015, Varoufakis resigned as finance minister in protest over the spending cuts and tax increases demanded by its lenders of Greece as a condition of the country remaining in the Eurozone. Yanis Varoufakis remains engaged in governance issues of the European Union. He's co-founder of the Democracy in Europe movement, DiEM25. That's a pan-European political movement founded in 2016 by a group of Europeans, including philosophers and activists. They see the European Union becoming a technocratic superstate. Yanis Varoufakis is the author of many books. The most recent are Another Now, Dispatches from an Alternative Present, Talking to My Daughter About the Economy, 2017 and the same year, Adults in the Room, My Battle with Europe's Deep Establishment, and The Weak Suffer What They Must, Europe's Crisis, America's Economic Future. Varoufakis was in conversation with Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. He's professor of Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University. His latest book is We Still Here, Pandemics, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. It follows on the success of the previous book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Flint to Ferguson. Professor Hill is host of Upfront on Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera English is a television news channel broadcast to the world by the Al Jazeera Media Network. It is the first English language news channel to be headquartered in the Middle East. Instead of being run centrally, news management rotates between broadcasting centers in Doha and London. The launch date was November 15, 2006. This interview took place on February 19, 2021. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of